CD summer of the quarter?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, okay. Well, welcome to the last Evolution and Ecology, or Ecology and Evolution seminar of the quarter. And I am delighted to introduce Professor Tadashi Fukami, who comes to us most recently from Stanford University. Ted reminded me that I missed a great opportunity to have him as my graduate student many years ago, and that was in the bad old days when non-resident tuition for international students went on forever. There was no escape from it, and that just seemed like something that was very difficult to guarantee, and so I missed a great student, but of course he went on to great things with Jim Drake at the University of Tennessee, where he did his dissertation. I think he also enjoyed interacting with Dan Simberlock while there. Before that, he did a very nice master's degree, and that was on a bamboo phytotomata at the University of Tokyo. He's now an assistant professor at Stanford, where he's just received a Terman Fellowship, which gives him that great oxymoron, extra research money. There's never extra money, but he's got some anyway, so that's good. He can get his program going, and it's good to have that recognition as a faculty member. He also was an assistant professor in Hawaii at Manoa and tore himself away from paradise to come join us in California. And he just does tremendously interesting work on community assembly, which he'll be speaking to us about today, working everything from theoretical models to microcosms, from microcosms to forest fragments, and he also works on fragments of forest, that is what goes in a little lump of decaying wood. He's done some really interesting work on that. If some of you would like a little more time with Ted tonight, we are doing the usual no-host dinner. That'll be at 6 p.m. Kathmandu Kitchen. If you would like to join us, come down and see me immediately afterward, just so that I make sure that the number of seats at the table match up with the number of people that are sitting in them. Okay, take it away, Ted. Thank you.
So I'd like to thank Sharon and myself for being a host to me. It's been a great day to talk to different people today, and I wanted to thank you also for coming to this talk. So, as the title says, what I'd like to do today is to talk about what I'm going to call historical contingency in community assembly, and rather than going into details of the results, the data that I have, I wanted to do just talk about ideas that I've been thinking about with some data sometimes to back up those ideas. So when you think about community ecology in general and think about particularly species diversity, if you ask different people what would be the most influential and important concept, I think many people would say that maybe not the only one, but the theory of island biogeography by Marcus and Wilson, although it's been a long time now since they published this work, this is still probably one of the most influential one, and I'm sure most of you know what this theory does, but just to, as a refresher, this is a simple one where species diversity is considered just a result of just two things, two simple processes. One is how frequently you are receiving species from some external species pool, if you're interested in understanding the number of species in whatever island community you have. So that's one process. The second process is extinction. How quickly species are going extinct from your community. It's just species diversity is just a result of balance between immigration rate and extinction rate. And it's nice because it's so simple that you can apply to any kind of more or less discrete habitat, like not even, it doesn't have to be terrestrial, it can be aquatic and any kind of discrete habitat, and including fragmented habitats. And just so you know, most of you probably know this book, this theory, just to tell you that it's still ongoing, active center of research. There is this book called The Theory of Island Biogeography Revisited, edited by Losses and Rickles, talking about how this old, now old theory, but still important theory has been extended to think about how we can improve this theory to understand species diversity and species composition and community structure in general. And to me, one of the several lines of research that have been very important in trying to improve this theory is to think more about the role of immigration history and how we can add that historical perspective into this theory of island biogeography. So instead of thinking just about immigration rate and extinction rate, we'll go into a little bit more in detail about immigration and think about not just immigration rate, but also some more details about immigration history and how that might affect what species are going to go extinct. So to tell you a little bit more about what I mean by the role of immigration history, let me think about some hypothetical case where you have multiple local islands in a given region, and just to give you some visual example, let me think about, let's say we have different kinds of islands in a region, and we want to understand how many species are living on these islands. So you can think about maybe tree species, tree communities, or a bacterial community, anything, or insect communities. And what increasing number of people have demonstrated is that even if you have the same physical and chemical condition shared by all of these local communities here, and even if all of these local communities have the same shared species pool, so everything is the same except immigration history. Even if you have, so I'm just saying the same thing here, I'm using this color to represent physical and chemical conditions. Let's say these are all identical. All of these mainly theoretical papers have shown is that just by varying the sequence of species immigration, you can end up having very different community structure even if you have the same physical chemical conditions and same species pool. So let's say we have a simple, just as a hypothetical case, let's say we have just 6 species in a species pool that are ready to colonize all of these local communities. And let's say we have different immigration history. So this island was, after some big disturbance, this species, one of the producer species, arrived first, and it was a second species, it was a herbivore, and so on. So this community has this particular history, and this community has this particular history, and so on. And because of some very subtle differences in how species are going to interact and how the outcome of species interactions, how that is very sensitive to immigration history, you can end up having a very different community depending on the history. And that's what I'm going to call historical contingency. And there are a lot of work trying to understand exact mechanisms about how this kind of historical effects can arise. But instead of going into so much detail into specific mechanism, what I wanted to do now is to think about this causal relationship. So we know, mostly from theoretical work, that sometimes immigration history can affect community structure like species diversity and composition. But I think what's still less clear is under what conditions we have to worry about immigration history effect to understand community structure, and under what kind of other conditions communities are more deterministic, so that you don't need to worry so much about historical contingency in predicting community structure. So that's the question that I wanted to go into a little bit when I was thinking about my PhD thesis, so some time ago now. And so one question, the first kind of question that I wanted to think about with you is, instead of thinking just about this causal relationship, I want to think about some kind of ecological context and how, if you have different ecological context, which is a little bit abstract, but I'm getting into more details in a minute, but how different kinds of ecological context may interact with immigration history to affect community structure. So as some examples of ecological context, I'm going to give you a bit of examples. One is productivity, another one is habitat size and size of species pool. So as one of the factors that may be considered ecological context, productivity is one of the many things that community ecologists have been interested in for a long time. So if you go out using this kind of pick the same simplified picture, a lot of people have been interested in asking how productivity, in this case, defined as something like the amount of energy and nutrients and other things that are available for community development. If you have some kind of variation in productivity among different communities, local communities, how does that correlate with species diversity? And as I'm sure many of you know, what this review and some other reviews have found that it's sometimes it's this kind of hump-shaped relationship where if you increase productivity, you can put more species into that community, but you can't increase productivity too much to have a continued increase in species diversity. So eventually species diversity decline. This kind of hump-shaped relationship has been observed in many kinds of communities. But that's not the only pattern. We also see this kind of just monotonic increase, and it may be just the part of this picture where we are looking at this. So we have this kind of relationship where the species diversity decreases with productivity. So it may be okay so far, but now we also have this kind of what we call U-shaped relationship where species diversity declines and increase with productivity. And we also have non-significant relationship. And according to, some of you may know this review paper, and there are also other papers. According to this review, which looked at hundreds of studies, none of these patterns seem to be more common, clearly more common than any others. So this may be 25%, this may be 25%, and so on. So it's a typical messy kind of picture we have in ecology. And obvious question is how we get this kind of variation in productivity-diversity relationship. So given this kind of variation, going back to the question about historical effects, but the basic, simple question I wanted to ask is this one. Oh, this is just to show you how nice Davis is. So Don Strom has a special feature just last year, and this is just to remind you that this is still an active area of research, the productivity-diversity relationship. So going back to the question of immigration history, this is the basic question that I wanted to ask. Can immigration history be one of the factors that can create this kind of observed variation in productivity-diversity relationship? To answer this question, I would have loved to go to these nice islands where I can study trees for a long time, but I nobody really can do that, because to think about community assembly, what you really need is a really good direct experimental manipulation of immigration history so that you can attribute what you observe directly to immigration history. And on top of that, you really want to do that kind of experiments over a long time, over many multiple generations of the species involved, to think about community assembly. And that's the kind of excuse that I often use to think about microbes as a good system. So what I ended up doing is, like Marcel and Sharon and many other people here also have done, I took advantage of the microbial community as a model system, and these are mainly protists that are bacteriophages, and these species that I use for experiment have been known to compete very strongly over things like bacterial as food, and there are also some predators, integral predators, that can interact both as competitive and predators. And using this system, about 20 species, I had a little cup where I just simply manipulated nutrient concentration to think about productivity-diversity relationship. So what I did is I had different kinds of experimental different treatments of experimental immigration history, and looked to see how productivity-diversity relationship vary depending on what exact history I used. So I had four different historical immigration history treatments to assemble these communities, and after about a month, which correspond roughly to 30 or so generations of these species involved, I looked at how productivity affected species diversity. And one of the four history that I used, I'm going to call A, when I looked at how communities looked like after a long time after community assembly, this is the pattern that I found. More or less increase, monotonic increase, although there's some kind of limit there. This is a second history that I used. In this history treatment, I couldn't fit any simple model, statistical model to this, so it's just a non-significant pattern. A third one, this is statistically significant decline in species diversity. So this is a hump-shaped relationship. And the last one, I also found U-shaped relationship, exactly the kind of variation that you might find in natural communities. So I am not going to give you too much detail into the mechanism, simply mainly because I couldn't find out exactly what mechanism were responsible for all of these. But I think it's at least clear that the productivity as one of the factors that you might consider as ecological context can actually, according to this just one microcosm experiment, can interact with an integration history to result in the variety of that patterns that we often see in natural communities because of some complex species interactions. In the same way, I also looked at effect of ecosystem size and see how that might affect species diversity. So instead of manipulating nutrients, in this case I just manipulated the size of jars and see what happens. And in the same way, habitat size can also, in a similar way to what productivity interacted with immigration history, what I found with this microcosm experiment is that habitat size can interact with immigration history to result in different patterns between habitat size or island area or ecosystem size, whatever you want to call it, and species diversity. A third factor that I wanted to go into is the size of species pool and the effect of that size on species diversity. Susan Harrison and Howard Cornell have thought about this kind of questions, and many other people have looked at this question a lot. And so as another topic that's been popular for a long time in community ecology is how when you have different species where you have just a few species, more species, and many more species in species pool, if you compare regions with different number of species in species pool, how does that affect species richness that you find in local community? And I also have to just give you a punchline here because I have some more things I wanted to show you. But what I did basically was a computer simulation, and what I found is that size of species pool can also interact with history to result in different kind of pattern that we often see in natural communities, scale dependent pattern between size of species pool and species diversity in communities. And this difference can be, you can get this kind of difference in the pattern because of historical effects. So maybe that was a little bit too fast, but the main point that I wanted to make here is that yes, the ecological context can interact with immigration history to affect community structure. And I was interested in reading, and I got interested in reading this paper, a relatively recent paper by Joan Rothgarden in 2009. What she said is that community ecology tend to be what she refers to as structural theory, where you have patterns that you observe in natural communities, such as productivity and diversity relationship. And given that pattern, you want to understand process. And that's usually how community ecologists tend to approach the problems. Instead, what John said is that we also have to come up with more of what she calls formational theory, where we start from processes that might drive community patterns, and we start from there and think about how what kind of pattern may arise from the process. And I think how we can think about historical effects is a way to think about formational theory, so with the emphasis on process. And there is some, as I think Mark Villan said here last week when he was here, there is some similarity to what he argued, I think, in his paper too, that in evolutionary biology, we often tend to think about natural selection and mutation and drift and so on as process, and the pattern comes kind of as secondary. We want to understand how evolution works, and once we have that, we can try to explain process. And in the same way, in ecology, like community ecology, maybe we should think more about local interactions and immigration history, those kind of processes first, and then think about pattern. And I think thinking about historical contingency in community ecology, community assembly, is one way to have a better formational theory. So all of this, all of the things that I talked about is, I think is, to me, I think it's nice because it gives you ideas about what may be plausible in natural communities. But of course, it's just computer simulation and microcosm experiments, and it doesn't really give you the idea about what actually happens in other kinds of field natural communities. So I think it's important to think about this question: does this kind of relationship actually happens under field conditions? And I got lucky a little bit because I had an opportunity to collaborate with some of the good people in Europe to take advantage of a really good long-term data set to think about plant community assembly. And that's not the only kind of studies that you can think about. There is a really good paper, as you may know, by John Chase last year in Science, and he did some good pond community experiment where he actually directly manipulated immigration history to think about community assembly. And so I think this is a good example, but I also wanted to talk about this study that I was myself involved in a little bit. So here what we have is in the Netherlands, they had this nice typical plant community plot where they saw different species of plants into initially bare ground, and the only thing that they manipulated experimentally was just the kind of species that they saw into different plots in the Netherlands. And after that, they just monitored plant community development over time. And they have been running this experiment now more than 10 years, so it's a relatively long-term data set they have. So here we have direct manipulation of initial immigration history because they manipulated the species that they saw, and we have long-term community monitoring. And what we found is that if you look at how species composition changed over time in these different plots, and if you compare how different plots are where different species were sown, and how that changed over time, this is the pattern that we found. So the initial point should be you can think of this as a kind of a reference point, because this should represent very different community structure among different plots, because it was experimental manipulation of initial community structure. And so if you think that the environmental conditions are going to determine what species can survive eventually in a plot, then you would expect to see the community dissimilarity decreasing over time because they share the same kind of environmental conditions. But that's not what we saw. What we found is that the big differences that we initially experimentally created was maintained over time, at least for 9 years or so. And you can visually see that. So I think even though for plants it may not be so long time, even 10 years, at least in this time window, you can say that maybe immigration history was important. What was a little bit more interesting to us is that if you do the same kind of analysis, looking at not just species composition, but some kind of functional composition, but the same communities, and do the same analysis and see how dissimilarity changes over time from 1996 and 2004, in this case, there's a statistically significant decline in community dissimilarity, meaning suggesting that if you look at functional structure of communities, immigration history effect is disappearing over time. So it seems like whether the answer to the question whether history is important or not seems to depend on what aspects of community structure you are interested in. If you're interested in specific species identity, what species you have in your community, maybe immigration history is important. But if you're thinking about functional structure of community, communities may be more deterministic and less sensitive to historical effect, which I think makes sense if you're thinking about, for example, available niches in a given place. So I think it's kind of nice that we have some kind of evidence from field experiment, but this is just one of the many field experiments that you can do. So the question, the natural question that comes up from this particular experiment is this question: if community structure is sometimes very sensitive to history, but sometimes not, depending on whether you look at specific taxonomic composition or functional composition, what does that mean to not just community structure, but ecosystem processes? From the results that we got from the plant community assembly experiment, you might think that if the history is not important for the functional structure of community, maybe historical effect stops here, because if these communities are functionally similar, regardless of what history you use, there is no arrow going from here to here and here. So that's the question I got. I'm getting a little bit more interested in. So one experiment that I did with my collaborators in New Zealand is to think about some kind of communities that should be very functionally very important. And of course, we tend to forget small things like fungi, but I think one of the functionally very important community could be, for example, wood decay fungi in a forest. And I thought this community would be a good system to focus on, to think about historical effects on both community structure and ecosystem functioning, because of several reasons. One is that, particularly in New Zealand, wood decay fungi can be very, very species, very, very diverse in species richness. And so if you have very many species, there's more room for sensitive historical effects to manifest. And another thing is that we know that within wood, which is their primary habitat, they can be engaged in very strong species interactions like competition and sometimes facilitation. And we know that species interactions are the key. It's one of the key components for historical effects to be important. Another thing that was important in thinking about this community is that, of course, fungi are very important functionally, because without these fungi, we will be the forest would be filled with lots of wood debris. And so they, as a decomposer, they're a very important group of species. So what we decided to do is, it's still kind of daunting to do this kind of experiment in the field, although we managed to do it, and we're trying to write up the field experimental results. But here I just want to show you what we found in the lab. And what we did, we had this small, simple jar like this big, and we sterilized everything, and we put fresh wood inside, and we had 10 species that we collected from this New Zealand beech forest, and we put all these 10 species in all of these jars. And to look at effect of immigration history, we just did a very simple manipulation where we put only one of them first, and we waited for 3 weeks until we put 9 others, and everything else was the same. And so this is one treatment where I think this was the first species that was introduced, and all other 9 species were introduced 3 weeks later in another jar. Maybe this was the first species that we introduced, and we waited for three weeks until we introduced 9 other species. And here is the species names, that name of the species that we used as those initial species. And we waited for about a year, which is much longer time compared to the time interval that we used, 3 weeks that we used to manipulate initial immigration history. And so after a year, we looked to see how many species were coexisting in wood. And what we found is a very strong effect of initial species. So if you look at, regardless of what kind of nitrogen availability that we used in these jars, if you use this species, the species richness was much lower than, for example, when we used this species as initial species. And it's across this nitrogen availability, the effect of history was very, very strong. And on top of that, we also looked to see what kind of decomposition they were doing. And we measured different things, but as a representative measurement, I'm going to show you what happened just simply to wood mass loss. And the magnitude of the effect is just as large as here, which is a community structure effect. And here, you can think of decomposition as one of the ecosystem process effect. Mm-hmm. And there's a really big effect on wood mass loss after 1 year or so, depending on what species you used as initial species. And we thought that it may be because we had some variation both in wood decomposition and variation in species richness, we thought it might be fun to look at a relationship between the final fungal species richness and wood decomposition, because many people are interested in that as a question as biodiversity ecosystem function relationship. And what we found is a really strong relationship between species richness and wood decomposition, but maybe a little bit opposite to what we might expect. More species you have, the slower the wood decomposition was. But in any case, I think one important point to make here is that unlike many other experiments where researchers experimentally manipulate species richness. So in one plot, for example, if you are thinking of plant communities, you introduce few species here and you introduce many species here. Unlike that kind of a typical experiment, what we did here is we introduced the same 10 species in all experimental treatments, and we just looked to see how many species were coexisting. And so both of these axes were created by immigration history, and we had a really strong pattern between these two variables. So the kind of diversity and ecosystem functioning relationship that many people are still very interested in, for good reasons, to understand those relationships, it may be important to think about how communities have been assembled, and something about historical effects is key to think about the diversity ecosystem functioning relationship. And so basically what I was trying to tell you is that immigration history affect not just community structure, but also ecosystem processes like decomposition, nutrient cycling. And although I didn't talk so much about it, we also had nutrient input and fungal consumers like Calambula, and we also found interactive effect between these two on both community structure and decomposition. So, do I have 10 more minutes or so, or 5?
You have at least 10, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So, I talked a little bit about this. Another way to maybe expand this kind of simple conceptual framework to think about evolution. So instead of just thinking about ecological context, without thinking so much about evolution, I was getting more and more interested in thinking about, like many other people, I was getting more and more interested in how we can include evolution to have a better understanding of community structure. So how do we include evolution in context instead of ecological context to think about historical effects on community structure? That's another question that I wanted to talk about a little bit. To do that, one of the more recent projects that I've been working on with people at Stanford is to think about going back to this relationship, history affect extinction. If history has a big impact on extinction, that's a little bit troubling to community ecologists, because it would mean that we need to know immigration history, and in many cases, it's just impossible to know any details about immigration history, to reconstruct immigration history, to understand any kind of natural communities in most cases. So it would be really useful to have some way of knowing. It would be really helpful if you have some idea about what kind of species in species pool are more likely to produce historical effects. And to get at that question, one way to look at it is to think about evolutionary background of different species in your species pool. So one question that I started to ask is this simple one. Does the strength of historical effect depend on phylogenetic distance between species, the species that you have in this species pool? And to ask that question, I have a relatively new system that I'm still learning, so I don't have many data to show you, but I wanted to talk about this new system that I've been working on. So I use flowers. This is the Mimulus orientiacus that's very common in California. And we think of flowers as a natural microcosm, and we think of them as a micro islands to think about either biogeography question. And what we did is I have an excellent postdoc, Kabir Pei, and a PhD student, Melinda, and with two of them, I've been working on this question. And what we did to start with, before getting into phylogenetic distance question, just to give you a bit of background about this system, we know that these flowers, which are mainly hummingbird pollinated flowers, they last about a week. And if you look at microbes that live in nectar, there's actually a lot of, particularly yeast, can be very common in very, very abundant in nectar. And we just counted how many yeast are in nectar, and there's this nice kind of a logistic type kind of a growth. And it seems like 3 or 4 days is actually enough for them to reach carrying capacity. So even though it's absolute time scale, it's a short, very ephemeral habitat. To the microbes, maybe this is actually a reasonably long-term, long-living habitat, if you think about microbes. So using this system, another thing I should tell you is that the way microbes move between these islands is by dispersal via pollinators, in this case hummingbirds. So if you see a yeast living in here, and if they have hummingbirds come to get nectar, and if they go here, that's how yeast seem to disperse between flowers. So with molecular work, what we found so far is that this community is not that species rich, and these 6 species that we found comprise almost all of maybe 90% of the species that you find, or I mean the 98% of individuals that we find in flowers. And so to start with, in thinking about priority effects and historical effects in this community, we try to do experiments in the field with real flowers, but it just getting a little bit challenging. So instead of doing that, we had a mock flower in the lab, which is a PCR tube. And we put 9 microliter nectar, which is about the same similar amount of nectar that you would find in real nectar. And we just introduced in a fresh nectar one of the species, a small number of individuals on day 0. And we waited for 2 days, and we put a second species, and we waited for 3 more days, and we plated them out and looked to see with the molecular techniques how many of the 2 species were there. And we did the complete set of pairwise combination of these species. So we had a complete pairs of species to do this kind of priority effect. So here, this was the first species, but we also had a reverse. We put this species first and then this species. And we looked to see if that relative timing, how that might affect which species may be more abundant or not. And to show you some results, so this is I'm looking at one of the species, Candida floricora, and this is a reference. We put water just as a reference. As long as this species was first species to be introduced, it doesn't matter which species you put second. They're abundant after 5 days. If you look at how they were doing if they were introduced second, then there's almost complete suppression of this species, depending on which species you use. But that's a really strong effect of the relative timing here. And since we had the completest set of pairwise interactions, this is a little bit complicated, but this is just a summary of what we found. All of these species that we looked at, they do very well as long as they are the first species, but if they are the second species, even though they do just as well, if the water, the reference was, so if you compare this and this, it's about the same. But if you put a second species, depending on which species you use as the first species, that species can completely exclude other species. I think overall, even though there's some variation in terms of the strength of priority effect or suppression, there is some very strong effects of first species. And it didn't matter which species you use as the first or second species. But I also wanted to look at this variation and see how you can explain this variation in the strengths of first, the strengths of historical effects. And so what we did, going back to the phylogenetic distance question, we looked to see where how these six species that we used were related to each other phylogenetically. And these, the red ones are the ones that we used in this experiment. And we looked to see how phylogenetic distance may be related to what we call invasion score. By invasion score, I mean how strongly the second species was suppressed by the first species relative to how they would do if they were introduced alone. So here, if you're competing with a closely related species, it turns out that they have a very strong negative effect. As you move out to more distant species there, the negative effect of the first species was less. Overall, although probably statisticians would say that this is a wrong way to use regression, but you would see a general trend that as you go, if you have more distantly related species, the negative effect is less. Another thing I wanted to show you is that these two species were actually not doing well in nectar, and it seems like there is some kind of antibiotic substance in nectar that's preventing these two species to grow too well. So I think it's important to look at just these four species because those are the ones that seem to grow very well in nectar. And even within this cluster, and so these are the species that are in here, looking at these four species, we still have this positive relationship between phylogenetic distance and invasion score. So it seems like you can look at phylogenetic distance to some extent predict how important history is going to be in thinking about community structure. So I think immigration history and history can affect, evolution history can interact to affect strengths of priority effect to affect community structure. And I have one more experiment that I wanted to tell you, but I think I'm running out of time.
Can you do it in 5 minutes?
I can.
Go for it.
So immigration history and extinction is two factors that are in this island biogeography theory. Of course, another thing, as a third factor, a lot of people are interested in evolution and diversification to another way to improve island biogeography theory. So there's a lot of really neat work by a lot of people, and these are my favorite example in thinking about how diversification rate, immigration rate, and extinction rate, all these three factors instead of these two factors, may in combination affect species diversity in local community. But one question I think hasn't been answered too well is if history is important over ecological time to affect extinction, is it also important to think about historical effect on diversification? So that's another way to think about evolutionary implication of historical effects. So I had a really nice system bacterial community called Pseudomonas fluorescens, and I did an experiment to introduce two ancestral genotypes to see how many species show up through mutation from these genotypes. And what I found is that the immigration history, if you change subtle timing of these two, the interaction of these two genotypes, you can have very different kinds of evolutionary dynamics happening. And one thing I wanted to show you is that Matt Knopf, who is another PhD student who is working with me, did a new experiment where we had ancestral genotypes with experimentally created genotypes with different prior evolutionary history. So this black one had a different evolutionary background, and we looked to see how prior evolutionary history may affect the importance of history. And because I'm running out of time, what I wanted to show you here is that depending on what prior evolutionary history this particular genotype have, the importance of immigration history was different. So here, if you compare this panel, and if you compare this dynamics and this dynamics, the only difference here is that we put this black one first, as opposed to here, this one was introduced after this reference genotypes. And because of simple niche preemption, the diversification was much less compared to here, so that's what I'm showing here. But there's one case where immigration history didn't matter. So here we have this particular prior evolution history, and I think we have some good reasons to explain why immigration history didn't matter here. But the point I wanted to make here is that the importance of immigration history seemed to depend on what kind of evolutionary background your immigrants have prior to immigration to a new community. So this is a summary that I wanted to show you. So I think there's a lot more to be done to think about historical effects on both community structure and ecosystem processes. And I think by thinking more about how different kinds of contexts, both ecological and evolutionary, I think we can have a little bit deeper understanding of community structure and implication for ecosystem processes. And I will stop here, and if we have some time, I'll be happy to take any questions.
How sensitive are contingency effects, or the magnitude of contingency effects, to the lag between the first and second species? So do you get greater contingency effects when the first species has been there for a longer period of time?
Yeah, so another factor that can be important is exactly what you said, how frequently species are coming, so immigration rate. And naturally, as you might expect, if you have a very frequent immigration happening with different species, then the extreme case is that the species are coming at the same time, then you don't have any historical variation that you might want to create. In that case, the more frequent immigration is, I think less important history becomes. So if you have an infrequent immigration, then I think that's where everything else being equal, that's where I think historical effects becomes more important. So that's kind of related to the original island biogeography theory, because one factor was immigration rate that was considered to be important.
I was wondering if you need another arrow from evolutionary context to immigration history, if the likelihood of being an immigrant has phylogenetic signal.
So from here to here. I can see that how evolutionary context can determine what kind of immigration history is more likely to happen. Yeah, so I think we need here, maybe here, and here. But I think the key is think about maybe, one key maybe to think about temporal scale. So although I'm showing these different eras as if these happened at the same time, maybe the arrow may happen in a slower time scale compared to, for example, here. So I think one way to think, to have a more better picture, maybe to think about the speed at which these different processes occur relative to one another.
In your phylogenetic distance and invasions experiment, before you moved away those two species and you had all six of them there, the relationship looked much more sort of wedge-shaped than linear, suggesting that, you know, that you have much better predictive power when you have 30 distinct species as opposed to when they were similar, right? So you could get either outcome, either there was no effect or there was a really strong effect when you had closely related species. And I'm wondering, you know, so you have six species here, right? But I'm sort of wondering what you think of that. Is that something that you think is likely to be sort of common, that our predictive power might get greater as we get farther away, or is that just a function of the six taxa that you have here?
I can see how this kind of, as you say, so you are referring to this kind of
yes.
Narrowing of the error. Yeah, this I think this could potentially be a general pattern that may be observed in other communities too, because what we actually have is here, we can kind of group this and this separately. So what's happening really here is that these two species have to worry about abiotic factors to do well, and so what the other species doesn't matter too much because the biotic effect is not too much. So that's why even though these are two very closely related, they don't affect each other negatively so much. And here what's happening is that these species are so clearly more competitive than these it doesn't matter which species you look at. Regardless of what species you look at here and here, the effect is strong. So this cluster is the negative effect of these species on this species, and this cluster here is the almost no effect of this species on these species. So here, because this species these two species are not doing well in this particular habitat. That's why I think we have this not so many variation in here. And here, the reason we have this variation is that it's actually opposite. As you go farther here, more distantly related species have a wider range of possibilities and invasion score. And that may be because something about just a simple statistical Brownian kind of motion idea where as you go farther in phylogeny, there is more room to be for evolution to go in different directions, so that the invasion score can be sometimes by chance very strong. The negative effect may be very strong. Sometimes it's not so strong. So that's why you have a lot of variation here. But as you go up here, if you're looking at very closely related species, it's always, regardless of which set of closely related species you look at, they are very ecologically always similar, so that the effect is strongly negative.
So then you might sort of say this approach makes more sense to sort of look within a clade of somewhat closely related species than making these cross clade comparisons.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at a system where there's differences in dispersal rates, which might have something to do with who colonizes first, do the ones that disperse a lot, if they are there first, do they tend to invoke less of this contingency effect than if you put ones that naturally don't disperse much in the colony originally?
I don't know the answer to that question. It may be that, of course, the immigration history is not entirely stochastic. We do know that there are some early successional. We call some species early successional and other species late successional. So dispersal ability can vary a lot depending on species. And we also know that often we see a trade-off between competitive ability and dispersal ability. So if the species that tend to arrive early also tend to be competitively weak, maybe their arrival early stage may not matter so much because they are going to be excluded anyway by later arriving species. So in that case, historical effects may not be as strong as you might expect, based on just an entirely random kind of species pool. So the kind of microcosm experiment where we just have a random kind of sequence and species pool could potentially be overemphasizing the effect of history on community structure.
So it seems like in your plant studies, you went towards traits and the, I guess in my animal-trained opinion, it seems like plants have very strong traits that can be measured easily. And then when you went to the microbes, you've gone for things more like phylogenetic distance and just species identity and things as boxes. And I guess I'm curious, sort of, can that phylogenetic view of the world, the evolutionary view, and the trait view come together? Is it, are we as community ecologists, in other words, going to have to start studying how evolutionary history relates to traits if we're really going to be able to sort of get a community assembly?
Yeah, I think that's one direction that many people are excited about now. So I do think that it should certainly help to think about evolutionary background of different species to understand how they interact. And so my answer to your question would be yes, definitely.
And so are there predictable relationships between phylogenetic distance and trait distance, or is it something that just varies from one group of organisms to another? Or where do we go with that, I guess is what I'm curious about.
I'm not sure. So I think it would be interesting to see if different taxonomic groups may be different in terms of the degree of correspondence between phylogenetic relatedness and their ecological similarity. If the plants tend to show more tighter relationship, if you know phylogenetic history of plant species, does that give you a better prediction of how ecologically similar they are, as opposed to some other kind of some other taxonomic groups? Do bacteria also show that kind of good correspondence between phylogeny and ecological similarity? There are probably already studies on that, but I don't know so much.
Yeah, I'm especially interested in your studies on wood decay. I think one of the things that differentiates that from some of the other systems is that wood changes, the chemistry of wood changes, its physical qualities change as these organisms act. So you had some of the species that you looked at are very common, Daldinia, Termites. We could go out in the forest here and find things that are closely related or the same species. But I noticed that some of these, like Daldinia, which is an the closestly related things in California are endophytes. And so they would have perhaps already been present on these logs when they fell down and decayed. And I'm curious, perhaps that's getting at this evolutionary strategy, but Daldinia slowing decay rate, perhaps slowing down the invasion of something that is a better competitor at later stages of decay. What do you think the interaction is there? And I guess also with your field studies, have you seen any sort of succession in decomposition of decay organisms?
Yeah, that would be an important thing to know. What would be the natural pattern in succession in actual forest? Unfortunately, I don't think nobody has good data, particularly in New Zealand, although there are really good mycologists and systematists. I don't think there's much known about successional patterns, and so we don't really know which species tend to occur in late stage in wood as opposed to early stage. But going back to your earlier comment about Daldinia being an endophytic species, I think that's an interesting thing to think about. So maybe if this kind of preemption and priority effect is very important, you can imagine that could be a strong selection pressure to become endophytic, so that you can always be the first species to start decomposing wood and as soon as the wood dies. So yeah, maybe something there that we can think more about in relation to immigration history.
Okay, I think it's about time to thank Pat again for a very good